Okay, so I have a few for our last session today. We have some more questions, and I have some that's written down here. So I'll go through these, and we'll see about those. But if you have any other questions you'd like to ask, then hopefully we'll have some time to talk about them later on as well. Okay, question number one. I've experienced that I can switch off or stop the thought process, but I'm sensitive to external stimuli such as smell, touch, sound, pain, etc. What is this mental status? Should I practice and cultivate this? Well, that sounds fine. What's happening there is because you are becoming quieter in your mind, less going on with thoughts, then naturally you become more sensitive to other kinds. It's just normal. This is what happens, doesn't it? I mean, if you go to a quiet place, then you become more sensitive to sounds. If you have a very clean floor in your house and somebody steps in it with just a little bit of dirt on their feet, and you can see the dirt there, yeah? So when your mind starts to become clean and clear, you'll begin to notice things much more vividly. And don't see this as being a problem. Actually, this is one of the purposes of meditation. We're practicing meditation in order to purify our consciousness, to become more aware. And when you do that, you'll find that the sounds become more vivid, the sights, the itches, the sensations, the energies, everything you feel and see and experience and taste, everything will become more vivid. Right? That's what it means to become more aware. Right? So sometimes when that happens, it can feel like, it feels like it's too intense or it's too much, and pain hurts too much, or it feels like there's too many things that's distracting you. But remember that these things are only very subtle, right? These things are only the leftovers. They're already so much more subtle than the things that distract us normally in life, right? I mean, you might be sitting there in meditation and a little bit of sound is distracting you, but that's a lot less distracting than sitting in front of the telly at night time, right? And having the television distracting you. Yeah, it's so much more subtle already. So this is just those residues that's left there. So just be peaceful, just be calm, and experience all those things that need to be experienced. Let them go. Okay. Okie dokie. One day, my managing director used some words in a rude manner over a trivial matter in the presence of other directors. I got hurt. A little later, I spoke to this person and strongly told that what she did is wrong and retaliated. She apologized. I felt that I should not have retaliated like this, and please tell whether this was due to my sakkaya ditti. Well, probably, I guess. I don't know. Well, there's a good story that I learned from, there's a book by one of the Thai monks, Ajahn Phuong, and in his book he tells the story of a lady who came to see him once, and she was had a little business selling noodles on the street in Bangkok. And she said that, she does a good job with selling noodles. Her noodles are good and she sells them at a reasonable price. But one fellow keeps on hassling her and tells her, if you're a Dhamma practitioner, you should just give your noodles away. How come you're charging money for them? Yeah? I should get free noodles when I come to you. And then he said to her, well, look, just next time he does that, tell him that you're not practicing Dhamma in order to become a fool. Yeah? So there's a difference between being aggressive and being assertive. Yeah? And sometimes it's difficult to know the boundary between those things, right? Especially if you're in a difficult situation. So it sounds like, that particular circumstance, as described there, was neither black nor white, or rather both black and white. So one of the nice things about the Buddha's teachings is that we don't have to fit everything into right and wrong, okay? And it's very interesting when I was in I studied philosophy. I studied ethics in philosophy in WA, and you're always trying to find is something right or wrong. Yeah, this is the question: is either right or it's wrong. And of course, many times it's extremely difficult to determine whether something's right or wrong. But from a Buddhist point of view, the Buddha said there's four kinds of karma. There's black karma, white karma, both black and white karma, and neither black nor white karma. Right? So we don't have to feel like our actions are going to be either right or wrong. Sometimes, yes, straightforward, this is the right thing to do. Sometimes this is the wrong thing to do. But sometimes it's a mixed thing to do. Sometimes it's both good and bad. And we just can accept that. We don't have to say at the end of the day it's one or the other. We just accept that it's both good and bad. And it sounds like that was one of the situations here. On the good side, you know, you were standing up to the bullying behavior, abusive behavior. On the good side, you know, that the person you spoke to accepted that and apologized, so you've helped them by doing that, so that's good. But then on the bad side, then you feel like you were perhaps acting out of anger and trying to hurt them and so on. So the important thing there is to look at what is it that actually worked? What was there that happened on that good side? And is it possible that next time that situation happens, that you can achieve those good outcomes but without that bad side there? In other words, can you learn to stand up when you're being bullied, to be assertive, to stand your ground, to not allow yourself to be manipulated or abused, right? And to explain the situation to the person who's doing that, and have so that they can apologize and so on, but without getting angry and without wanting to hurt them. This is the trick. So one thing I think is important as Dhamma practitioners is to not double guess yourself too much. And sometimes we can be so concerned that we're going to be doing the wrong thing that we end up not doing anything. Yeah? So don't be crippled by your Dhamma practice. Don't be crippled by self-doubt. Yeah? If there's something you need to do, you do it. If you need to stand up for yourself, you stand up for yourself. If you need to say something that's difficult to say, you say it. But you just try your best to say it in the best way. Sometimes, even when we're angry and upset, we still need to say things. I mean, of course, it's best if we can go away and let go of our anger, make sure we feel equanimous, and then come back and say it and make sure we don't have any anger, right? That's ideal. But sometimes we can't do that, right? Sometimes you don't have that luxury. So you have to speak in the heat of the moment, and you have to learn how to control that. Yeah, you have to learn how to manage your emotions, right? So being able to let go of the anger is even better, but if you can't let go of it, at least don't let the anger overwhelm you. So you feel it, you know, okay, I'm angry, I'm going to be doubly sure that I'm going to speak kindly, even though I feel angry, yeah? So one of the ways that I would do to do that is that when I felt angry and I'm talking with people, I would always lower my voice and speak very quietly. So if you ever hear me speaking like this, be very worried. Okay? And so sometimes you can at least you keep it manageable, right? You might not be perfect, but at least you try not to say anything that's going to be too much. But really important, don't let the Dhamma silence you. Yeah? Right speech is not no speech. Yeah? If you look at how right speech is described in the suttas, it's always he speaks words that are meaningful, that are going to the heart, that are pleasing, that are spoken at the right time. Very important factor of right speech. Yeah? Words that reconcile those who are divided, unite those who are in disharmony. Words that are on the Dhamma, on the Vinaya. Words that lead to the ending of suffering. And so right speech is not to have no speech. Right speech is to speak words that are going to be meaningful and helpful for the person that we're speaking to. That's why right speech is so much harder than keeping silent. You know, I've had this discussion on some of the retreats I've been on recently, because, you know, usually when we do retreats we keep noble silence. But what not many people know is that the Buddha actually made a Vinaya rule forbidding the monks from keeping a vow of silence. You didn't know that, did you? Not many people like to talk about this. The Buddha actually made keeping a vow of silence is against the Vinaya for the monks and nuns. Yeah? And why? Well, because sometimes there are things that we need to say to each other. Yeah? And sometimes we can use silence as a way of lying. Yeah? actually says that in the monk's vinaya when we recite the Parimokkha, the rules of discipline, and it says that when we're reciting these rules of discipline, if you've broken any of these rules, then you should confess it, and if you don't say anything, then by that we assume that you haven't broken those rules. So if you have broken them and you don't say anything, then you're lying. Yeah? So silence can be a lie, and silence can be very aggressive and very painful and very hurtful. Yeah? So it's not right, and silence is not right speech all the time. Sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not. Right? So when we're in those environments, in the workplace and these kinds of things, we have that responsibility as Dhamma practitioners to help others. Right? And so in that case, you know, what you did there, I think on the whole was good. You did the right thing and you helped your boss. Because if your boss was abusing you, always remember this. You might say, well, I'm a Dhamma practitioner, I can deal with it. I'll have metta, I'll have patience. But you remember, if they're doing it to you, they're going to be doing it to somebody else. And to somebody else. And the more that they get away with it, the more that they will become a habit and the harder it will be to undo it. So if you speak to them, again, you speak to them kindly and wisely. Tell them, you know, you didn't have to yell at me like that. You could have said what you're saying much more kindly and simply and I would have understood it, and so on. And then you can help them to be a better boss. Yeah. It's not easy to be a boss. Yeah? I've done it. It's dukkha. You know, I could have a bit of compassion for the poor old bosses, you know. Boss has got to be the one who does the most work. And whenever anything goes wrong, you say, yes, everything's my responsibility. And when everything goes right, you say, it was the team. And Gerald Ford, the president of the United States in the early 70s, he said that, here I am, I'm the president of the most powerful nation in the world, and still I tell people to do things and they don't do it. People assume sometimes that bosses can sort of get anything done that they want. They just give the word and it happens. But it's not like that at all. Yeah. Anyway. In life, when you're meeting people who are unpleasant, avoiding such people would be the easiest way out. However, could this be giving in to one's ego? Should one try to be humble and meet such people in life? How would the Buddha have advised? Well, it depends. It depends. Sometimes people are unpleasant. Well, can be our teachers. They bear our bodhisattvas. And a story about this was told by a Vietnamese nun in Perth, Venerable Huệ Khan. And she tells the story of a man who got married and he loved his wife very much, but he hated his mother-in-law. Terrible, terrible mother-in-law, always screeching and yelling and bullying and all of these things, and he just couldn't stand her. So he went to the temple and he asked for some advice and said, you know, what do I do to overcome my anger towards my mother-in-law? And because this is in a Mahayana tradition, then they said you should chant the word of Kuan Yin, the goddess of compassion, and then she'll help you have compassion. And so he went back and chanted the name of Kuan Yin, chanted, and nothing came. Came back a week later, said, nothing's happening. They said, be patient, go back. And so they went back and practiced more and more and more. Came back, still nothing happening. They said, don't worry, be patient, go back, and chanted on and on and on and on. Until one day, when they were chanting, the mind got very, very peaceful. And in the distance, there was like this light appeared. And this vision started coming. And this kind of manifestation, and he could see all the lights, and he could see the form of the goddess of compassion. Kuan Yin was coming towards him. And as Kuan Yin came towards him, so beautiful and so covered in, you know, beautifully dressed and all of the lights and everything was so lovely. And then he noticed that the Kuan Yin had the face of his mother-in-law. So it's like that. But also, you know, when you're with others, you know, don't always be thinking about, you know, how they're affecting you, but ask yourself, you know, what can you do? How can you be a refuge for them? You know, there comes a stage in when you're in your emotional life and your emotional connection with other people. You know, when we're always kind of wanting things, we're sort of wanting to get things and so on. But then, actually, at a much deeper level, you know, we connect with people much more meaningfully when you're not always asking what can you get, but you come back to what can I give. And rather than thinking, well, how is that person harming me, then you're thinking, well, how can I help that person? And very often what you find is that we don't notice the effect that we have on others. Yeah, we think that it's nothing. But then sometimes much later, maybe years later, they might say, oh, actually that was really meaningful when you did that. Yeah? That was something that was very powerful. So if we can be a harbour and a refuge for people, especially when they're in need, and sometimes just the smallest gestures can have great power. Okay. When meditating, the mind wanders away from breathing, or metta. When we realize this, we bring our mind back to breathing. Is this common? How can we overcome this and be able to concentrate and be mindful of our breathing and metta? Well, go back and listen to the talk from this morning. Don't try to concentrate. Don't try to focus on the breathing. Don't worry about your mind wandering. None of these things are important in your meditation. What's important in your meditation is to be peaceful. Okay? Peace of mind doesn't come from bringing your mind back anywhere. Peacefulness comes from quietening down the forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay? This way of thinking about meditation is so ingrained. It's so hard to see it. It's like a new paradigm to way of looking at meditation. Don't worry about the wandering mind. Look at the sources of the wandering mind. Why is your mind wandering? It's wandering because of greed, hatred, and delusion. So let go of your greed, hatred, and delusion. Your mind will be still. Right? Wandering mind. People think that because the wandering mind is common, people think that the wandering mind is natural. But these are two different things. Okay? Right? The fact that something happens all the time doesn't mean that that's natural, right? The fact that something, the frequency doesn't mean it's natural. The nature of the mind isn't to wander. Okay? Nor is the nature of the mind to be still. Right? The nature of the mind is to be conditioned. Let me repeat that. I want you to consider this very carefully. The nature of the mind is not to wander, and the nature of the mind is not to be still. The nature of the mind is to be conditioned. So when the conditions are there for the mind to wander, it will wander. When the conditions are there for the mind to be still, it will be still. That's all. So if we want the mind to be still, we have to understand what are the conditions. And those conditions, of course, are pancha nivarana, five hindrances, or we can consider it as greed, hatred, and delusion, or whatever way we want to talk about it. That's what is causing our mind to wander. So if we learn to let go of those things, let go of the five hindrances, yeah, little bit by little bit, the mind will gradually settle down. So we need to focus much more on the subject, on where these things are coming from, rather than sort of continually trying to bring the mind back and continually trying to try to train it. I'll give you another example. Imagine that you had a child who was going through school and who was having learning difficulties, right? They didn't like to read. You know, they were at that age when the other kids were picking up learning how to read, and they were falling way behind. And so every time they go to class, the school teacher would give them some assignment and say, read this. And then as soon as the teacher's back was turned, they'd be messing around and playing and trying to do something else. And whenever they got the chance, they'd skip school and run away. Yeah? The reason why I'm thinking about this example is because I know somebody who was like this. And they got so far behind in things. And so this young man that I'm thinking of, it got so bad for him that at some times he would literally be dragged into school by the police. Huh? Because he'd be going off messing around somewhere and the cops would come and physically drag him into the school, put him there. Right? This is what we're talking about, isn't it? My mind wanders and I bring it back. Well, this is what happened. This kid wanders, the police bring him back. And no matter how many times they did that, he didn't get anywhere. Right? He just goofed off again the first chance he got. And because, why? Well, because he'd fallen so far behind, it was a hassle. He was trying to learn, but he couldn't. He couldn't read. He couldn't understand things. He couldn't figure out what was going on. And he'd fallen so behind that it was just too difficult for him to catch up. So when he was in his early... I started this out as a hypothetical question, but now I realise it had a real example behind it, so I'm gradually switching over to the real example here. But anyway, he ended up coming to the monastery. He went originally to a Chinese temple and a few different places and ended up with me at Santi Monastery. And when he was first there... You know, he really struggled with things, like when he'd be doing Dhamma classes and things like that, and sometimes he'd just get too frustrated and have to sort of get up and leave the room. Because he couldn't keep up with things, he couldn't cope. Yeah? But at the same time, you could see he's actually a very intelligent guy, and had a love of learning. He really wanted to learn. You know, so I took the time with him and tried to inspire him and tried to encourage him and support him, lead him on little bit by little bit, and to find that actually he responded so well to the learning, and he had that love of learning, right? So I never had to go and chase him down and drag him and bring him into the class. If he didn't want to come into the class, that's okay. You leave the class, it's all right. But when he wants to come to the class, then you receive him warmly and kindly and respectfully and try to do your best to teach him, yeah? And when he did like that, he really flourished and responded well, had a great understanding of Dhamma. After a few years, he left the monastery, went back to his lay life, look after his father, who was very ill. And then he went back to study again, got his high school degree, got the top marks in the year for finishing his high school diploma, and then went to university. And now he's either still at university or maybe just finishing his university degree in psychology and social work and so on. So, you know, he's gone from someone who literally couldn't be kept by force in school to somebody who's got very good qualifications and loves to learn and loves, I think. So how do you do that? Do you do that by making him come into the classroom and sit there? No. You do that by inspiring his love of learning. Now, same thing in your meditation. You don't keep the mind still by making it come back to the meditation. You do that by inspiring a love of the meditation. You inspire this state of mind where you just want to meditate, you want to be still, you want to let the mind calm down. And when you can do that, you won't be worried by all of these distracting thoughts and things like that. Okay, so there's another couple of questions here which were also asked in the interview, so I might skip those because I think we already answered those. Okay, Dhamma helps us to live a wholesome life, or even a wholesome life, one or the other, wholesome life/existence. If this is so, why is life considered to be suffering and getting out of samsara the main objective? Aren't we born in this world to live and have a wholesome existence? Would that not be the most obvious purpose of existence? Okay, sure, if you want to do that. I'm not here to tell you what the meaning of life is. Live and have a wholesome existence, who am I to complain? Good luck, enjoy, yeah? But, you know, when suffering happens, I reserve the right to say I told you so, okay? So sure, if somebody wants to live and enjoy their life and have a wholesome life and help others, who am I to complain? Terrific. You go and do that. And if you say, isn't that the most obvious purpose of existence? Sure. But the most obvious one is not necessarily the most profound one. It's not necessarily the deepest purpose. So don't mistake the teachings of the Dhamma and these teachings on dukkha and samsara and things like that. The purpose is not to make you feel depressed. And it's not to devalue what's going on with your life. Right? You think about the story of Siddhartha and how he came to ordain. Yeah? It wasn't that somebody came along and tried to persuade him that he shouldn't be enjoying his life in the palace, right? No one came and said, oh, you shouldn't enjoy all this stuff because life is dukkha, right? It came from his own inner need. It was he who saw that this was dukkha, that this was just impermanent, that wasn't anything behind it, right? And this is what happens to people. This is the story of Siddhartha, is the story, I think, is ultimately the story of all of us. And there comes a time in our life when we realize that there's a hollowness to all of these things, and that all of those things we thought were good, to live and have a wholesome existence and help others. You know whose teaching that is? You know who we find in the suttas who's teaching that? That's Mara. Right? Mara comes to the Buddha and says, oh, Buddha, why are you living here in the forest and your robes are so thin and the nights are so cold and the ground is so hard? Wouldn't it be better for you to go back home and you can sleep in a nice comfortable bed? Ah, and you can help lots of people. Yeah, you can make merit and go to heaven, and you can help your family. Mara is very kind. He's very compassionate. Yeah, all he just wants you to be happy. Ah, oh, he says, you're suffering so much there. Please go and be comfortable and happy. Right? So it's not a matter of you know, having to do one thing or the other, but it's that deeper level of Dhamma, which I would call like an existential level of Dhamma. It's not a response to a particular kind of tragedy or sadness, right? Sometimes it is. I mean, sometimes, you know, people have that when maybe their partner dies or something like that, and then they're inspired to go and practice Dhamma. So sometimes it's a specific event, but in other cases it's really not. It's just a growing awareness of the nature of mortality, the nature of life, and a feeling that any true liberation lies with something beyond, something other. So if you're a true disciple of Mara, and you want to follow that path of enjoying a wholesome existence, and that's fine. Yeah. I'm being a bit facetious here, but I hope you don't take it in the wrong way. But you know what I'm saying is just you know, if you want to just live that good life, and if those teachings on dukkha and samsara don't mean much to you, that's okay. Just leave them to one side. Yeah, maybe sometime in the future you might come back to it and say, ah, that's what it was all about. Yeah. Sometime in the future, maybe you'll feel in yourself that need for something else and that need to look beyond. And then you realize that these teachings in the Dhamma were actually pointing to something. Okay. Okay. Next question. What are your observations and what is your message for us in traditional Buddhist societies re our practice of the Dhamma, considering the focus on ritual and the weight given to the knowledge of the Dhamma versus actually trying to live it? Well, first thing I'd say, I'm not saying these things. Somebody else is saying those things, okay? So don't blame me for it. Look, this is something that comes up constantly in Buddhist traditions, and we find the same thing, even though my first visit to Sri Lanka, and I'm not very familiar with Sri Lankan culture and practice of Dhamma here, but I lived in Thailand for 6 years, and so I know that scene a little bit better. And you hear the same kind of question there very often. On the one hand, yes, obviously, the practice of Dhamma is not about all the practice of rituals and things like that. And personally, I think we should try to keep those things simple and light, not too much emphasis placed on them. I think a bit of rituals now and then can be nice, a bit of chanting we do together and some, doing some flower puja or something like that. It's a nice way to bring people together with the Dhamma. And so, I don't think these things are bad, but I think that just they have their place. I remember one time when I was talking about this with one of the monks, Adam Pasano, in Thailand, and I guess I expressed what a lot of people feel is I felt that. Since I'd been in Thailand, I'd discovered the Dhamma and I'd discovered incredible riches and benefit from practicing the Dhamma. And I was just puzzled. I couldn't understand why so many people just didn't seem to care. Yeah? Why it is that, to me was, it was just the answer to what I've been looking for, that so many people spend their whole lives trying to understand and try to find a way, a sense of value, a sense of meaning, a sense of finding peace, finding liberation. And here it was. And yet, people seem to go about their lives as if it doesn't matter. Just ignoring it, or just paying only lip service. Maybe come to the temple once a week or something like that. And I just couldn't understand it. And Ajahn Pasano said, he just laughed and said, that's just how it is. He said, in any society at any time, there's only a small percentage of people who are really interested in spiritual practice. Yeah, that's the reality. Most people are interested in material things and prosperity and security and so on and so forth. And that's how it is. It's just true in Thailand, it's true in Sri Lanka, it's true in Australia. So, what you find when the Buddha was teaching, the Buddha never taught in a Buddhist culture. Right? The Buddha taught in a multi-religious environment. Right? I discussed this a little bit in the talk last night, but we often imagine that ancient India was Hindu. But this is a very inaccurate historical idea. Actually, the notion that India has always been Hindu is just a piece of Hindu propaganda. The only people who really believe that is the Hindu historians. And when the modern study of Indian history began in the mid-19th century, the first generation of Indologists more or less believed that, because that's what the histories, the Puranas from India said. But then when they got hold of the Pali texts and they began doing some archaeology and digging up the different sacred sites, they began to realize that this was completely untrue. For example, you have from the period up to about 200-400 AD in India, you find almost no Hindu archaeology in India, right? No Brahmanical gods or anything like that. It's all Buddhist and Jaina. And even after that time, it's still mostly Buddhist for quite a few hundred years. Right? So the idea that's just one example with the archaeology. So the idea that somehow India has always been this timeless realm of Hinduism, that the Buddha was teaching it was a Hindu, is just false. Actually, India was multi-religious. Many different religious strands there. Many things that we know of today in Hinduism didn't exist in the time of the Buddha. Many things that did exist in the time of the Buddha don't exist today. So it's always been changing and evolving. So when the Buddha was teaching, in the culture that he was teaching, that many of the many of the functions, religious functions in life, were done in a way that had no particular relationship to Buddhism. So things like, say, ceremonies when children were born, or when marriages were held, or funeral ceremonies, and these kinds of things. And these were all maybe like festivals for the rice harvest, and the new year, and the change of season, and so on and so forth, or like offerings for local gods. You know, each village might have its own shrine for a local yakka, and things like that. And that was being done all over India in different ways, and really had nothing to do with Buddhism. And the Buddha didn't have to deal with those things, because they were already being done in the culture, right? So from the time of King Ashoka in India, and then, of course, from the time of Duttugamanu and so on in Sri Lanka, you had the emergence of the idea of a Buddhist culture, right? Which is a kind of different kind of thing. And in that Buddhist culture, you then have to do all those things like marriages and deaths and change of life rituals and seasonal rituals and all of those things which help to hold the communities together and so on. And so Buddhism sort of partly became adopted to do those things. Sometimes they remain outside of Buddhism and they're still done in the, you know, in the Hindu shrine or something like that. And so Buddhism's always had to negotiate these things. So, in a sense, it's understandable why some of these things become introduced. But what it does is it gives a chance for everybody to have at least some contact with the Dhamma, right? So even if most people are never going to be great Buddhist philosophers, most people are not going to be great meditators, right? Most people are not, you know, they're happy to come along and do a little ritual or something like that, and they can go home, and that's all they want. That's okay. Nothing wrong with that, yeah? So the only problem comes is if we mistake it, and if that's all there is, yeah? So if we think of it as giving an opportunity for everyone to have a taste of Dhamma, then that's fine. But if we really want to practice, then the most important thing is not the rituals, actually. You know, one of the things is very, very noticeable. If you look at the Eightfold Path, there's no mention of rituals in the Eightfold Path. That's shocking, right? That's shocking. You're in ancient India. You're in India, for goodness sake, right? The land of rituals, the land of mythology. Every day is governed by rituals and Brahman mantras, and hey, Brahmins come and do the Gayatri mantra to make the sun come up, and then everything is they offering ghee to the gods, and everything is ritualized and so on. And the Buddha just comes along and says, it's irrelevant. He doesn't even bother to say, don't do it. Right? It's so irrelevant. If you want to do it, well, whatever, do it or don't do it, doesn't matter. As long as you're not killing any animals or something like that, then he's like, he didn't really care whether he did rituals. It's irrelevant to the spiritual path. And so what you find in the Eightfold Path, what's left out of the Eightfold Path is just as significant as what's included in it. Yeah? And if we look at religious life as practiced both in Buddhism and in other religions around the world, many of the things which are so important in religious life, right, are not found in the Eightfold Path at all. Yeah? So it doesn't say build big temples. It doesn't say do Buddha pujas. It's not there. You could probably make a big long list of things that Buddhists do all the time that are not actually in the Eightfold Path, right? Again, this is not to say that you shouldn't do those things, right? As long as the things that you're doing are not harmful, then okay, you want to do them, you do them, yeah? And sometimes they can be used to support and help your practice of the Eightfold Path, and so that's fine. But just remember, that's not the essence. And the essence is those things which, you know, we come back to all the time, is important. Right view. You practice your right view by listening to Dhamma, discussing Dhamma, reading suttas, reflecting, thinking about Dhamma. Right intention. Yeah? Letting go, compassion, kindness, right speech, speaking words that are true and meaningful, right action, keeping your precepts, right livelihood, making your living in a way that doesn't cause harm, yeah? Right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. These are the things that are really important. So with the rituals and so on, you can take them or leave them. That doesn't matter. Yeah? But the Eightfold Path is what really matters. The other point that was mentioned in that question was the valuing of knowledge of the Dhamma versus actually trying to live it. Well, it's important to be a bit nuanced here. Of course, you know, Dhamma is meant to be practiced, right? Obviously. But still, it's better to know the Dhamma than it is to be to not know it, right? Even if you're not practicing, right? So if somebody learns the suttas or learns the Dhamma or something like that, good. That's good. That's one of the factors. Right view is one of the factors of the Eightfold Path. Yeah, it's not right effort and right mindfulness and right samadhi, but it is right view. Yeah. So it's one of the factors of the path. So it's not wrong. It's just incomplete. So you shouldn't ever disparage or put down somebody who's studying the Dhamma, even if they're not meditating. That's fine. You should respect the fact that they've studied the Dhamma. And if they have something to share and you can improve your understanding of Dhamma from that, that's great. Yeah? But they should know that just by practicing the Dhamma is not a full practice. So, you know, often you find that these things go through phases and that you'll feel differently about this at different times in your life and different times in your own practice. And there are some times when you really feel that need to learn. And you really feel a thirst to say, oh, I want to find out what's this meaning in the suttas? What's this? And trying to get all the answers. What's dependent origination all about? And trying to unravel all of these things. And then after a while, there comes a point when you think, okay, that's enough. Yeah, I don't understand everything. There's still plenty of questions I could be asking. But I feel full. I feel like that's okay. I've got enough understanding to keep going for now. And then, you know, you feel more like maybe inclining towards meditation. So we each have our different paths through this. And the most important thing, I think, is that as, you know, if we want to meditate, that's great, but we should do at least a little bit of Dhamma study, learning suttas and listening to Dhamma as well. And if we want to listen to Dhamma and study suttas, that's great, but we should do at least a little bit of meditation as well. Yeah? Yeah? So that never do these things. They shouldn't exclude each other at all. Okay, so that's all the questions that I've got written down here. So any other questions from the floor? I know people came into the interview, they had all kinds of questions in the interviews, but they're too shy to ask them in the public. Yeah. Do we have a microphone? Yes or no? Doesn't look like.
Question about the role of deities, Pante. About
role of deities?
Yeah, about devas. I mean, do they have any relevance at all to this path? Can you just keep them completely out and go along the Noble Eightfold Path? Or can they help in any way? What's the interaction there?
Well, you know, if there are devas around the place, then it's probably good to stay on good terms with them, right? So, but yeah, I mean, this is one of the fundamental principles in Buddhism, is that the devas are just as deluded as you are, so you can't hope for too much from them. And of course, the Buddha was Sattva Deva Manusanam, the teacher of gods and men. So ultimately, devas can't do all that much for you, and probably you can do more for them. Yeah, and so. The most important thing with that is simply the understanding that in terms of karma and rebirth, you know, we come from an endless past, and we make our choices and make our karma in this life, and we don't know where that will lead us in the future. Yeah, and so this understanding of karma and rebirth is very important. But in terms of doing pujas for the devas or asking them for favors and things like that, well, I'm not sure if that's all that important. There's a lovely story, it's not a Buddhist story, but a story from Carl Jung, the great psychologist, wrote in his one of his books. Because he was kind of agnostic about the beliefs in the afterlife. Right? But one time he had either a dream or a vision, I can't remember now whether it was a dream or a vision, but at that time his father had passed away many years previously, and his mother was on her deathbed. Okay, and so he had this vision, and his father came to see him from the beyond. And Jung was like so amazed to see his father, and so, wow, really fascinated, and wanted to ask him, you know, what's it like over there? What's happening over there? And, you know, his father was curiously uninterested in answering any of those kinds of questions. And he said to Jung, he said, you know, I hear that you've become well known as a psychologist. He said, yes, that's true. He said, and you counsel people, you know, to come to you with all kinds of problems and so on. He says, yes, that's true. And his father said, well, you know that your mother and I never used to really get on all that well. And I hear that she's just about to pass away soon, so she'll be coming to join me. I wondered whether you might be able to give me some advice. Yeah. Okay, next question. Down the front here.
On hypnosis.
Hypnosis?
Yeah, because I've read a couple of books written by Dr. Brian Ways, who's...
Doctor who, sorry?
Brian Ways.
Brian Ways, okay. Not sure.
He's also a psychiatrist, I think, but later on he cures his patients using hypnosis,
okay.
Where they... start talking about their previous lives and
okay,
things
yeah.
like that, and then he kind of relates it to Buddhism.
Hmm.
And I just want to know if you have any views on that, whether it's really, I mean, I'm not really interested in it, just curious to know whether
okay.
There's any solid, if it's real or
okay.
reliable.
Okay, well, hypnosis obviously is a genuine thing, and obviously a very curious phenomenon. I've never been hypnotized or done hypnosis. I don't think I've ever even seen anyone under hypnosis, so I'm very unfamiliar with it, but from what little I've gathered from reading and from talking, I have also a friend of mine in Sydney who's one of the leading Buddhist psychiatrist in Sydney, Dr. Eng Kong Tan, sort of learned how to do hypnotherapy when he was as a younger man. So we talked about it a little bit also. Certainly hypnosis is a genuine phenomenon, and it seems that it can be helpful in certain circumstances. So there seems to be that there are some things that hypnosis can help you with. But I don't think it's ever going to take you very deep, in the sense that because it's not integrated, right? And this is one of the things with it. It's not like part of the Eightfold Path or something like that. It doesn't affect all parts of your life. It's just something that switches a switch in your mind or something like that, or in your brain, and puts you in some altered state of consciousness for a period of time. Now, in terms of recalling, accessing memories and so on with hypnosis, this is something that's extremely controversial, and I would personally recommend to stay away from. There was, and I'm not that familiar with it, but somebody may have more details, but there was a fairly major scandal in psychological and psychiatric circles regarding this, I believe in the 1990s. Because what happened was that there were a number of therapists who claimed to be accessing early childhood memories that people had, and children would remember being abused by their parents and this kind of thing, and it later turns out that those things never happened. Right? So this is not merely inaccurate, it's extremely damaging, right? I mean, if you've got children perhaps grown up children by now, coming and saying that their parents had sexually abused them, right? When they hadn't, yeah, then that destroys families straight away, yeah. You have to be very, very careful with this. Now, if that's the case even for early childhood memories, how much more so is it the case for past life memories? Yeah. So, is it possible to recollect past life memories under the influence of hypnosis? I suspect it is possible. Are some of those memories accurate? May well be the case. But I would be very, very cautious about accepting any such memories as accurate unless you're going to be very, very careful to verify everything objectively. Now, I'll give you one example where that was done well. There was a large-scale study done, I think it was in England. I read about this a number of years ago, so I can't recall all the details, but they did hypnosis on children to try to recollect their past lives. And it was a large-scale study. I think it was like 100 kids or something like that. And they collected all of their stories of memories of their past lives. And it was a very, very interesting study because what they did was that they recorded the memories of the children as they reported them. And the striking thing was that nobody was like a superhero in their past lives. Nobody was like the king or the queen or something like that. They were farmers. What did you spend your time doing? Working in the fields. What food did you eat? Porridge. Yeah? And they had very, very ordinary lives, which were very unlike the kind of lives which you'd expect children to imagine, and very much like the kind of lives that most people in history have actually had. Yeah? There was one detail which was quite most interesting was that they had the kids accurately recollected the history of forks. You didn't even know forks had a history, did you? Right? Now apparently, at some point in Europe, people started using forks with two prongs on them. Right? And so when the kids had memories from that time in Europe, forks had two prongs, and then later on they had three-pronged forks. And the kids correctly remembered that the forks had three prongs on them. Right? That's pretty extraordinary. That's not the kind of detail that a kid is going to make up. Right? And it's not the kind of detail that they're going to just randomly pick up or know from somewhere. So, you know, that study to me was quite powerful and quite convincing that they had, you know, in that case, on a fairly large scale, had been able to recollect from their past lives. But to me, if you want to, you know, understand this, there has to be that level of research and reflection and inquiry to make sure that what's going on is correct. Otherwise, I would be very cautious. Yeah. Okay. One more question. Venerable has one. Tim.
Bhante, I would like to ask you about now within this samadhi meditation circles, sometimes we see one particular group of teachers might say, okay, just focus on your meditation object and just keep at it and carry on with it. So because of that, again, we hear often this word concentration, which is quite a phenomenon. And on the other hand, Ajahn Brahm and some other teachers would say, okay, you have to let go, do nothing. And with the mindfulness, you gradually gain the samadhi. In both cases, sometimes we hear, okay, in both cases, in the meditators claim that, okay, I got the jhana and this attainment and kind of many kinds of samadhi and all. So I wonder whether is there any kind of samadhi which can arise through the concentration, like okay, the holding to the object, grabbing hold to an object, kind of thing, because the other way around, what Ajahn Brahm says, okay, according to Sutta, says is quite obvious. I would like to know what are your comments about it.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, I think, you know, you always have these different approaches to meditation, and the different approaches will always work for different people. So I think, you know, personally I think that we should encourage as many different forms of meditation as possible. and different approaches, because then that gives people a variety and gives people a choice. I think the two real main problems that come with the different meditation techniques is, number one, when people are very dogmatic about it, this and only this way is going to work, and when the second problem is when people are too extreme about it and think, right, this isn't working, I'll do it twice as much. It's still not working, I'll do it four times as much. And you keep on sort of bashing away at it until something happens. So these, to me, are things which are quite dangerous. But in terms of the different approaches and so on, then we should let as many different variations and many different approaches come as possible. And in fact, I'd like to see a lot more different approaches than we see today. And I can only see a benefit in having those things. We all have the opportunity to go and practice in these different places, try out those techniques. And if you're going to practice in a different tradition or learn a different technique, the only thing is that when you're doing that, practicing in that tradition, give yourself 100% to that. Okay? Don't go and practice a Paok tradition and then thinking, oh, I should really be doing the Mahasi tradition. And then you're sitting in the Mahasi retreat and then you're thinking, oh, I really wish I was practicing Ajahn Brahm style. And then you go and do an Ajahn Brahm retreat and you're thinking, oh, I really wish I was... Yeah. When you're doing it, you do that 100% and you see what that's going to lead to, and then you'll know for yourself. You don't need to worry about that. Yeah? In terms of the results of the practice and so on, actually, I think a lot of these things, some of these things come from different personalities and different personal approaches, but also sometimes it comes from different cultural circumstances. And one of the things to me which was really important in my understanding of Dhamma was when I spent some time in northeast Thailand and practicing in the forest monasteries there. Because if you've heard the teachings of the forest monks, like Ajahn Man and Ajahn Mahabhu or even Ajahn Chah and so on, they're really kind of, you've got to strive, you've got to put forth effort, like Ajahn Mahabhu used to be a kickboxer. Right, so he has this, and he still has that kind of kickboxing approach to Dhamma. You've got to get in the boxing ring and smash the defilements down and beat them over the head and kick them around. Right? Actually, this is kind of beside the point, but you might have gathered from how I've been talking today that that's not really my style to sort of talk in that kind of way, right? But I was on one retreat I did many years ago. I was doing an interview, and this one woman came for the interview. And for some reason, I don't know why, I maybe just read a book by Ajahn Mahabhu or something, and I said, oh, sometimes you've just got to kick the defilements and knock them down in the ring and so on. And this woman just gave me a very strange look, and she said, do you know, I'm a professional boxer. I didn't expect that, right? So there's these different styles. Right? So when you hear this, right, some people get very scared, right? You hear about, oh, these monks saying, oh, you've got to be really tough and you've got to practice really hard and so on. I think, my goodness, it must be so hardcore in those monasteries. Because if you go and stay in those monasteries, the monks are so relaxed and so at ease, and you go there, everyone's sabai, sabai, sabai. Yeah. And you realize, well, that's why the teachers were teaching like that, okay? They weren't teaching because that's how the monks were. They were teaching because that's what the monks needed, right? Because in that culture, the people, it's a very relaxed culture. People like to take it easy. They're very happy, yeah? And you need to give them a bit of a kick, get them going, yeah? And of course, if you look at someone like Ajahn Brahm and his teachings, why is his teachings evolved in that way? He's in a completely different environment, right? He's in a modern urban setting. And actually, I think that the difference here is not really a difference between Thai culture and Western culture or something like that. The difference is really between urban and rural culture. I think pretty much urban environments are pretty much similar around the world, right? And it's all dominated by go-get-em ambition, get better marks in your exams, get higher wages and, get more promotions and buy more things and so on. And so there's all this attitude of going out and getting and achieving and so on. And so if you're in that environment, what do people need? Well, people need to stop stressing out about it so much, because people will come to the monastery, and if people come to the monastery and you say, yeah, go for it, practice really hard, kick the defilements down, then it would be really hard to say if you say, hey, just calm down, okay, just relax, take it easy, don't try to achieve anything, don't try to get anything. And then, because people have those qualities, they already have, yeah? And so this is different qualities that teach for different people in different circumstances. It's not something we have to think, there's no kind of right and wrong, but just different approaches can be helpful for different people. Yeah. Okay, so I think we're just about finishing up now, and so we'll call it a close, and we're going to be doing another short session of a few interviews after this, so I won't go too long because we'll miss out on the interviews. So I just wanted to say thank you for your attendance and your good practice for today. I believe tomorrow we're having a new crew in, so most of you I won't see tomorrow. But anyway, you have all my blessings, and please keep up the practice, keep up your meditation. People sometimes ask me, how much should I meditate? So my usual recommendation is to do at least minimum of 20 minutes a day, 5 days a week. Okay? That's your minimum. And the reason I say 5 days a week is because if I say do it every day, you'll miss out a day, and then you'll be like, oh, I missed one out. But if you do 5 days a week, you can miss one, and you're like, oh, that's all right. Yeah, it's okay. Right. So that's a minimum as a basic practice, and if you can do more than that, that's terrific. So keep up your practice, keep up your meditation, but remember that it's not you doing the practice, okay? So if things go badly, don't get depressed. It's not you. If things go well, don't get elated and proud. It's not you. It's just the Dhamma, okay? So you let the Dhamma do its work and get out of the way. Okay.